welcome to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate, the lightly science, mostly goofy podcast where we take silly questions and do our very best to find the real hard science answers. I am a host, Julian Huguet.
I am another host, Trace Dominguez, and we have a guest here with us today.
Another host, science communication dabbler. He's a writer and producer for Practical Engineering. He's got a biology background, and you may have seen him hosting planetarium presentations for over a decade. So really, all sorts of different kinds of science rolled together in one man. It's Ralph Crewe. Welcome, Ralph.
Hello.
What
hello.
An intro.
What an intro. That's the best intro I've had all day.
He
Thank
could
you.
Have maybe even sold a house to you.
That's actually also true. In the early, mid-2000s, I did sell houses.
Oh, you know what? Actually, my question answer involves a teeny tiny bit about buildings and real estate.
Ooh, good wow. tease. Good tease.
I'm intrigued. I want to listen to what's coming next.
So as we mentioned, this is a show where we take questions from listeners, from each other, from guests, and we do our very best to answer them. The sillier, the more ridiculous, the more absurd, the better. And kicking us off this week is Trace. Trace, what was your question?
So my question comes from this person. His name is Julian, I think. Julian Huguet.
Is he Swedish? He sounds sexy.
He is, you know, some people would say he is.
Some people would say he's Swedish, or some people would say he's sexy. You didn't commit.
Yes.
You have to commit. Which is it, Trace? Is Julian Huguet sexy or Swedish? Yes.
Yes. And or. You gave me an out. You said and or. Julian, you asked this question. You put it in our questions database. By the way, listener, if you want to submit a question, go to thatsabsurdshow.com/ask or look in the show notes.
Just for the record, I'm not Swedish, so therefore, by process of elimination, I must be sexy.
No, no. Challenges from me.
That's how it works out.
I like that Ralph is just sitting there smirking at us.
I was trying to come up with a Stockholm syndrome joke, but I just couldn't get there because I kept on being distracted by the sexiness.
The longer I keep you trapped here, the sexier I become. That's the Stockholm syndrome with me.
That is Stockholm syndrome. You just described it. That's it.
Yeah,
oh, there we go. Awful. We finally got there.
So this question comes from Julian, and we haven't used a question from each other in a while. So this is a fun change. We've got a lot of listener questions and we love them. We've got a lot more to get to. So lots of podcasts to make. But Julian, you asked, are there any other systems of timekeeping besides hours/minutes/seconds?
Yes. I mean, first of all, I despise working with like standard, quote unquote, units of measurement, right? Like the 12 inches, the 5,280 feet in a mile. Like, I just hate it. I do a lot of like tinkering and working and like building and stuff in my free time. And every time I have to use like fractions of an inch, I cry inside, and I much prefer working in metric. And, you know, it struck me that we've got such a beautiful, elegant system that's based on, you know, base 10 with metric for just about everything except for time. Time is still all wonky, yeah, and uses 24 hour days and 60 second minutes and 60 minute hours, and I don't like it. And I've wondered if anybody at some point has pointed at each other, probably the French, because the French, you know, are the people who were in charge, like the standard units and measurements, right, were all devised by like French people 200 years ago. But do you think they ever went like, mon Dieu, this 12 hour day is absurd? I've checked the data.
I feel like they still do that.
What is life if we must live by these 24 hours?
If we must abide by this
the
clock.
Tyranny of the clock. I would cut off its head and spite its face.
Ralph, the more ridiculous accents you can do on this podcast, the better it's going to be for you.
Okay. I got to work on... I mean, like, by the way, that French accent you just did, that was that the Little Mermaid? The guy?
The witch guy?
The Le Poisson guy? I think so. I mean, you know, actually, you'd think I'd be, I was born in Quebec,
oh,
in Canada, so I should be able to do a French accent.
You should.
But I also feel like it's extra bad if I do. So
you could just speak French, really.
Un petit peu, mais je suis très bête.
I mean, that's already better than what
I cannot.
We did.
I cannot speak.
I've checked the data. I don't think we have any listeners in France. So for now, we're safe.
Oh.
France
is not the only place that they speak French.
I mean, that's as a hockey fan, right? Yeah. You've got Quebec. You've got French Guiana. Yep.
All of Canada.
You've got, yeah.
Yeah. Cameroon.
Probably.
Yeah.
Morocco.
Haiti.
The Ivory Coast.
So, Julian, you nailed it on a couple of different levels. So I want to give you props for that. The French did come up with a metric time. It's actually called decimal time. I'm going to get there in a minute. But let's talk a bit about where time comes from and a little bit about how we got to this weird 24-hour, 12-hour, 60-minute, 60-second situation. Mm-hmm. Before we do that, though, I need you both to do something for me. Ready? You're going to close your eyes. And when I say go, I want you to count to 10 in your head and get as close to 10 seconds as possible.
Oh.
And then when you get to 10, open your eyes and say, that's absurd. Okay. Please elaborate.
Hold on.
Okay?
Siri,
ready?
Set a timer for 10 seconds.
No, you can't cheat.
Okay.
You can't cheat. That's the point. Ready?
You didn't say no cheating at the beginning.
Okay, well, here we go. I'm going to say go. Ready? Go.
That's absurd. Please elaborate.
That's absurd. Please elaborate.
Did you hear my phone alarm go off or no?
I did hear your phone alarm go off, you cheater.
I think I keep perfect time.
Man, I feel like I was slow. I feel like I was a bit behind there.
So neither of you did well, but that's fine. It doesn't really matter.
Well, I started from when Siri started. It's her fault.
Sure. The point is, if we played that over and over again, do you think you would do better or worse each time? Do you think the variance would just go wild? Like, what do you think?
I think I'd get better for a while, and then I would devolve into an altered mental state where I'd been trying to count to 10 too many times, and I'd get kind of off.
Yeah, I think it would be just a total scatterplot of, like, no correlation between performance and, like, how many actual reps we did. I think I'd be all over the place if I did it in earnest repeatedly.
Well, I mean, I think I would never be longer than an hour or less than a second.
You'd be within a variance of a few seconds of 10.
Yeah, within an order of magnitude at least.
Sure.
And my point with this game is that time doesn't exist. And so we are trying to calculate something and to break down this stream of consciousness, this stream of the universe, if you will, into something that makes sense to us, which means the second is just sort of invented, as is the minute and the hour and everything else. There are some things, though, that we can objectively measure. So let's do a kind of quick and dirty history of time. So ancient people, they would see the sun rise and set. Easy to measure, always happening over and over again, and it's happened since forever. And so that is where the day came from. Probably the first measure of time was something like that. Hey, it's been a day. Okay, cool. A year, also important, easy-ish to measure. If you live long enough, you can measure that over time. You get the same seasons over and over again. You get repeating events that happen. But to really calculate it, and I think Ralph is going to nerd out a little bit about this. What do we need, Ralph?
In order to calculate the length of a year?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would probably be measuring the length of the day and then see when, because like we have a shortest day of the year every year on
Correct.
The same day. So yes. I would probably measure solstice to solstice, which
Ooh.
As of this recording, boy, we're close to a solstice.
Yeah,
too.
We
I'm
are.
Very excited are. About it.
Oh, right. We should probably add to our intro that this is a New Year episode.
Oh,
at
yeah.
Some point.
Happy New Year. Time has no meaning.
Yeah. Happy New Year. This one will air on January 4th. So anyway, yeah. That is exactly right. Ancient people would measure the year based on solstices, but also based on star movements and how things would change in the sky. Again, objective measures, that things that happen year over year. The ancient Chinese would use a combination of the solar calendar, which is when solstices would happen, but also, I think, something that we forget about is the lunar calendar, which is that moon is changing phases constantly, and we can see it, so people would measure from new moon to new moon again. Early on, Egyptians had a 360 and then kind of tweaked it and got a 365-day calendar following the sun and the stars, and literally saying, okay, Sirius, the dog star, which they had a different name for, they would say, oh, that's in the same place this year and next year and the year after that. So we will be able to measure how long it's been since that happened by counting the number of days in between. The Central American Olmec and Maya, they had accurate calendars to 365 days as well. And then the Romans come along and are like, okay, we've seen how the, you know, the Greeks first and then the Romans, they were like, okay, the Egyptians had this really good calendar. Let's see if we can improve on it. And they realized, okay, it's probably actually 365 days and a quarter. They had already figured that out.
Yeah. And that was the Julian calendar. Just throwing that out there.
There's no way it's a coincidence that we're here talking about the Julian calendar.
Yeah.
So the Julian calendar, I think, let me double check.
It was named for Julius Caesar. I think the Senate named it in honor of him, you know, before, I think a year later, then they all knifed him in the back. So
yes, the Julian calendar has
Julian. Also, we're going to mark March 15th on there, just, you know, no reason.
In ancient Rome, the spot where Julius was murdered has flowers on it to this day. There's like flowers left there.
Wow.
In the ruins of ancient Rome.
From like some secret admirers like coming along and leaving.
People who are like, yeah, he was a big deal. We like him.
Miss him. Miss that guy.
Miss him. He was so nice. He was really friendly to my kid. So the point is, yes, the Julian calendar, we had 365 and a quarter. It still could use improvement, of course. You know, it's actually 365.2545, blah, 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 blah. And then that was the Gregorian calendar, which we now use, where they realized, oh, if we skip leap years in day or in years that end in centuries, essentially zeros, then you can kind of stay accurate to within.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous amount of accuracy. That's
except
fine.
Except every four centuries, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's every
did
4 years.
Did we do that in 2000 or no?
2000, we did not leap year, even though it should
it
have
was
been.
An unleap year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But 2100, we will not have a leap year.
But this year is a leap year. Yay!
Yay!
2024. Happy leap year.
My anniversary is on leap day.
So this will be
really?
Your first anniversary.
It will. It will.
Oh,
my wife is going to be in the Galapagos Islands for our first anniversary 4 years after we got married. So we're spending
That sounds awesome.
I mean, great for her, but I'm just going to be here like...
You should totally dress up as a tortoise and surprise her.
Go surprise her there. Okay, so we've got the Julian calendar, we've got the Gregorian calendar. Those are like wide views that we can base on observing the stars and the planets and the sun and the moon and everything else. Also seasons, the Nile would flood in North Africa seasonally. Northern China, they would measure things like the awakening of insects and be like, okay, well, that happened on this day. And they would send these calendars all over their, you know, regions to say, this is important. You know when to plant, you know when to do all this stuff. Tracking that for harvests and seasonal changes is part of modernization of society. However, when it comes down to like subdividing a day into time, that has a lot less importance for a regular agrarian society. Do you really need to know the difference between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. just in ancient time? Not necessarily. That said, there are times when it's important. And so the ancient Sumerians and then Egyptians did come up with this, where you would divide time based on day and night originally, and then slowly by measuring stars and constellations, they divided it into smaller chunks, and they used base 60, which is weird, right? Base 60 is a weird thing. We use base 10 for metric, okay? And it makes total sense, right? You have 10 fingers. You can count to 10 easily. It's easy to move the decimal points. You get a lot of zeros in there. The thing with base 10 is it's divisible by 2, 5, or 10. For integer, base 60 is divisible by 2, 3, 5, 6, 10, 12, 15, 20, and 30. So it's actually a better system in some ways, depending on what you're trying to do with it. And this is many thousands of years old. So when the Sumerians came up with it, or so some researchers think, they did it because it was two groups that came together, and one used base 5 for your five fingers, and the other used base 12.
And the common
language between the two would be base 60. And so the Sumerians came up with it. Now, if you're wondering, who the heck would try and make base 60 the basis of your mathematics? So I found a USA Today piece who refer to a theory from researchers at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. If you are going to count to five That's easy. You have five fingers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You're going to count to 12. Any idea of how you would do that without writing it down or a calculator?
10 fingers and 2 nostrils. When you put, you get to 10, and then you stick each index finger in a nostril, and then it's 12.
12.
And then you start again.
That
you just walk into a place and you're like, I need a dozen.
give me this many with your fingers.
I need 1,000 things, please.
Clearly, that's it.
Sorry, Ralph. Go ahead.
Yeah, Ralph, what's
no,
your
I
idea?
I think that must be, that obviously is the right answer, right?
It's going to be something so obvious when he says it. Like, what could it be? What is it, Trace?
Count the number of segments in your fingers,
not
the number of fingers. So if you hold up your hand and look at it, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, not counting the thumb, of segments in your four fingers. Now, if you want to count to 12, that's pretty easy if you do that. Now, if you're trying to keep track of numbers, you can be like, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Got it. Okay. Now, if you want to count to 60, because it is divisible by 12, you use your other hand.
Wow.
Point with your pointer finger. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Put your pointer finger down. Start with your next finger. Seven, and then you just keep going, and you can get to a number in between using two of your hands. You'll know exactly what number you're counting to because you're keeping track of base 12 on your way to get to 60. It's so interesting to think about. And it does sort of like blow my mind when I read it.
Who is the person, the first person to be like, hey, we're really limited by our 10 fingers that we're counting on, but I have devised a brilliant way to get to at least 60.
I think it was somebody who owned more than 10 chickens or something. You know?
That's it. That's probably exactly the problem they had. It's like, yeah.
I need to sell this large number of chickens, but I don't have enough fingers to do the math.
How do I track them?
And you said, well, it's three fingers of my right hand and, you know, 8 segments, so I know I have X number of chickens. So it's an easy way to count using two hands and just the segments of one hand and the fingers on another. It's so clever. And that was, they think, why they used base 60. So even today, though, it's very confusing to us to think about the number of minutes and seconds as this base 60 number. For them, it was fine. And 12 goes into 60 very easily. So the number of hours or segments of a day was 12. Egyptians and Sumerians used 24-hour time. It was 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night. And at different times of year, those hours would be of different lengths. They didn't necessarily need to be like exact numbers throughout the day or the year. It was just like, oh, the hour is generally throughout the day. And they would use sundials and water clocks throughout history to measure this. And that's when things started to get more and more and more precise. Also a combination of the lunar calendar and the solar calendar. So as we started to put all this together, we got all these different time systems, which is the answer to your question, Julian, that yes, there were different time systems. We all use this Sumerian Egyptian system today, but that was not the only system out there. So even though it doesn't always make sense, I'm going to tell you some of the other ones and they make almost less sense, okay, but are still important to the various cultures that came up with them. So China and Japan had one day divided into 12 Zhis. And then the Zhis were divided further into Kaos or Keys. I'm not really sure. Anyway, it was translated as marks into English. And marks would actually vary. The number of marks would sometimes be about 96 in a day, sometimes 120 in a day. Different emperors would have different interests in dividing the day differently. So if we used 100, then each mark would be about 14 and a half minutes, roughly.
Yeah.
14.24 minutes. And then the qi or marks were subdivided again into fen, and the number of fen also varied. It could be in the hundreds or the thousands. So later they divided the zhis into another division. So they had 12 zhis, and they had the initial zhi and the central zhi, which were two different versions of it. Basically, they divided then into 24-hour hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
But backing up a little bit, you said specific rulers could change the values of time,
yes,
like when they came to power for whatever reason.
Yes.
I'm just like, I hate like moving. I'm in the middle of a move. And I hate having to gather all my crap up and put it somewhere else and arrange it and then know that in 2 years I'm going to do it all over again. Can you imagine having to relearn timekeeping because some emperor came to power and then like they get assassinated 2 years later and you're like, oh, we have to do a completely different unit of time. Yeah. What a nightmare. What a nightmare that would
exactly.
be.
Exactly. And it was very confusing. They also had sundials and water clocks, and it was based on like the latitude of whatever the forbidden city was, you know, so China even to this day uses one time zone, which is wild. So it's just, but if you think of it as like a 12 unit day with 24 subunits, 100 different marks within those subunits, then 8:30 a.m. as we call it would be 35.42 key or 4G, depending on how specific you want it to be.
Of course.
And then at exactly 36 key or mark, there would be, that would be about 8:30, 8:40 in the morning. And 9 a.m. is like 4.25 G or 37.5 marks. So, you know, and to make it even more confusing, sometimes depending on whether you're, sometimes the Xi didn't start at midnight, they started at 11 p.m. the previous day, depending on when you're looking at throughout the history of China. So it's a very complicated system. The thing is, you don't necessarily need it to live your day-to-day life, right? The day is the most important thing. You're going to meet in the morning. You're going to meet in the midday, the afternoon. And it, that ever-changing system was fixed in the 17th century where they divided the day into 100 marks.
Right.
And then they adopted the Gregorian calendar in 1929 and everybody was like, oh, thank God.
it's over.
That 100 feels kind of metric, doesn't it?
It does feel kind of metric, yeah. So that's ancient China. In Japan, they also had that system, but they used it slightly differently, and it's still very complicated. But they also adopted the Gregorian calendar at some point in the 20th century. So in ancient India, they had a completely different system, and I'm going to try and pronounce the words. I'm going to get them not correct, but they had the Ahura Traintu, which is the time of one day and a night, so essentially 24 hours in modern hours, but they didn't use those. And they divided that Ahura Traintu into 30 Muhurta, which is 30 segments. They divided those 30 segments into 30 Kala, and that would be what we would call a minute. And then they subdivided those kala further to include rates based on human biology. So they had the aksara, which is a syllable, the namesa, which is an eye wink or blink, and then they had the prana or asu, which is the breath or pulse rate.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so it was a day with 30 hours, allegedly, then 30 minutes, and then they would subdivide those minutes into smaller pieces.
Gotcha.
And to translate that into modern time, 30 hours of 48 minutes and 30 minutes of 96 seconds is sort of how to think about it.
I see. Okay, so their 30 minutes was equivalent to like 48 of our minutes, basically.
Each of their hours is equivalent to 48 of our minutes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, similar. The Catholic missionaries that showed up in the 16th century introduced the Gregorian calendar. And then in the 18th century, when the Brits took over the country, they imposed the Gregorian calendar upon them. They still, both China, all China, Japan, and India use their original traditional calendars as well for measuring festivals. That's pretty common. But everybody's now using the Gregorian calendar for, you know, calendar years.
It's interesting that we have so many like different starting points for timekeeping and the world more or less is all kind of on the same one. And I bet it all pretty much has to do with conquest and commerce, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
100% conquest and commerce. And then after the conquest has rolled back in the case of India, you know, the Brits left, they stuck with it because, again, commerce. It's so much easier to trade if you're all using the same time. India, I believe, also just has one time zone. And the time zones we're not even going to get into because that's its own crazy stuff. But that comes into play later once, you know, everybody's using the same time. We realize it got even more complex.
Right.
But I did want to get into the ancient Maya because we talk about ancient China and ancient India a lot. But the ancient Maya also had a calendar. You've heard of it because, if remember, in 2012, everyone thought the world was going to end.
Oh, yeah. Did that ever happen?
That was the Mayan New Year, essentially. But it wasn't. It was just the end of one Baktun in the Mayan calendar, the 13th Baktun, actually.
Oh, happy Baktun, by the way.
Yeah, happy Baktun to you. So Mayan time is based on days. Each day is called a kin, and every 20 days is a yunol, and every 360 days is a tun, and every 7,200 days is a katun, and every 144,000 days is a baktun. At the end of the world, again, it was the 13th baktun. And then there's the long count cycle of 5,126 solar years. And so they had this whole calendar figured out and knew that there were more than 360 days in a solar year, and they would just like add those days on when they needed them, which is amazing. And then they also have a universal cycle, which is 2,880,000 days. So they just counted the number of days from when they started counting and never stopped counting, and they made a calendar that way. They're just like, okay, cool. We just kept counting days.
Well, I bet the guy who wrote that song from Rent where they count how many minutes there are in a year was glad that we didn't use Mayan time.
How many seconds are there in a baktun?
Yeah.
Wow, yeah.
8 quadrillion, 295 billion. How do you measure... measure a baktun.
And the Mayan priest is like, we measure it with this giant stone round. I've got it right. I don't understand. The song makes no sense.
You can't measure in love. What are you talking?
We measure in tun and katun and baktun.
We have a wheel system.
The cool thing about the Maya is that they started counting and just kept counting. So if you go to their first day, it was August 11th in the year 3114 BCE. And from then, that's day one, and they just kept counting.
Can you imagine if 1,000 years from now, somebody discovered like a stack of old calendars from our time, just like puppy calendars or sexy fireman calendars, right? And like that for some reason they'd printed like 1,000 years into the future and then just stopped printing because they're like, we're not going to need sexy puppy calendar. Oh, sexy fireman.
Whoa.
We're gonna need calendars of puppies and Speedos. We don't need that.
But like they just stopped printing them, and then whoever found them was like, oh my goodness, the ancients stopped, their calendar stopped, therefore the world will end. Like, that's the conclusion you draw from it.
My in-laws have one of those like Far Side calendars where you pull off every day and like you just get to the end of it and that's it.
Yeah, that must mean they predicted the end of the world. Like, what a leap. What a logical leap that took.
Wow.
Trace, you don't want that sexy puppy calendar I got you for Christmas?
No, please just keep that.
I'll take it back.
Yeah, thank you. So obviously, we don't know what the Maya would have done had they continued because they were destroyed by the European settlers. But China, Japan, India, and basically everyone at this point use the Gregorian system. And the reason they do that is because, as you said, some conquests, some commerce, but also it was the most accurate. It was the most accurate calendar. Everybody adopted it because it's the evolution of these ancient peoples in the Middle East who figured it all out. They subdivided their day based on their base 60 system, and we just use it because the Sumerians and Babylonians and ancient Egyptians used it, and astronomers and researchers and scientists over millennia continued to use it. And so we just do. But if we didn't, we might use decimal time, which was attempted in the 1790s in France.
Yes, it was the French. I knew it. I knew the French would try that.
They used it for 16 months. And then we're like, no, we will not be doing this.
Or 1.5 decamonths. 1.6 decamonths.
I think it might have been decimes. I looked it up. I don't know.
Boy.
Anyway, so think of it as base 10 metric time. So a day has 10 hours. Each hour has 100 minutes. And each minute has 100 seconds. So each day has 100,000 seconds in it. All right? So noon is 5. Midnight is 10 or 0, depending on how you think about it. And a minute would be equivalent to 1.44 normal minutes, like Babylonian or Sumerian minutes. A second would be 0.864 freedom seconds. I don't know. Whatever we want to call
them. Sumer seconds.
Whatever term we want to use. The cool thing about decimal time is just like metric, all time is easily divisible by moving the decimal. You just have to remember to switch from hours to minutes. So you move it 2 decimal points to go from hours to minutes, but otherwise you just move one. So let's say 1 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it could represent time. It would be one day and so many hours, so many minutes, and so many seconds, which we still use in computers, right? You still have like D, capital M, capital M, capital H, capital H, you know, so on and so forth when you're doing like time for computing, because it's really just counting seconds. So if you have 123,456 seconds, then in decimal time, that's 1,234.56 minutes. That's 12.3456 hours. That's 1.23456 days, because it's all translatable, which is kind of cool.
Why did they get rid of it?
Because it sucks to use. It's just like not easy to use. They also tried 10 months in a year of only 360 days. So each day would be, there'd be 3 weeks in a month, 10 day weeks, 10 months a year, which adds up to 360 days. And the other 5 days were called supplementary days. And knowing France, that probably means it was a holiday, but it's hard to say.
Lunch.
It turns out it's just really hard to not continue to use the time that we have been using. We've used it for thousands of years. And so just switching to like these weird hours that are longer and like longer weeks, it was arduous. And so they, 16 months in, they were just like, this is not great. Let's cancel it. When it came down to it, a lot of it is it's cultural, it's historical. We've just continued to use this system and slowly refined it over time. I've said time a lot.
Over time.
But time isn't really real outside of the solar year is real, like we can measure it. The day is real, we can measure it. But minutes and seconds and hours, we made that up. That is totally
arbitrary.
Made up. And so we just keep using it because we kept perfecting it and it kept working.
Okay. And so metric time, we've tried it. The French tried it. And even though they've made all these lovely changes to create the metric system that's been so useful on time, they were like, you know what? This is bogus.
Yeah.
We're ditching this.
It was just hard to get everyone to move to literally new clocks, longer minutes, longer hours, longer weeks, fewer weeks in a month. Like it was just, it's people were like, this is lame or whatever that is in French. They were just
interesting.
Like, merde. You know,
that's probably it.
Are we going to have to beep that?
I don't know.
That's a great question.
I don't think we do.
Only if the podcast goes out in any of those French speaking territories.
Only in Algeria. Yeah.
I do think, interestingly, we still do essentially today what the Mayas did, which is at some point we turned on atomic clocks and we just have to keep counting the number of vibrations constantly, and we can't ever miss one or time will be off because we use atomic clocks as the standard measure of time now, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. So we've got all these atomic clocks, and if you stop counting for even one vibration of a cesium atom, you've messed up because we've made time exactly these number of vibrations. Right. It's like whatever, 9,192,000,000 something. And so like every time a cesium atom vibrates that many times, it's like, okay, that's 1 second. But we just have to watch forever, just like the Maya did.
We have to watch.
Oh, that's so, pretty good catch.
Wow.
Nice.
So yeah, the answer to your question, yes, there were other timekeeping systems. They were complicated, just like ours is. But ours was pretty accurate, so we continue to use it. Thanks, ancient Sumerians, Babylonians, Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, and everybody else who still uses it.
Thanks. Mostly, I'm just going to try the base 60 counting system now on my fingers. That was the biggest revelation for me.
Yeah. If I can ever get over 10 chickens, I'm definitely switching to that.
Welcome back to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. If you're just tuning in, I don't know why that would be in a podcast. If you accidentally fast-forwarded, this is a show where we answer ridiculous questions with lots of science research. I'm your host, Trace. We're also hosted with Julian and Ralph, our guest today. And up next with his question from a listener is Ralph. Ralph, before I play the listener audio, do you want to introduce us to this question? What do we got?
So the question that we've got is, this was such an interesting question to me. It is, can we evolve or engineer ourselves to breathe continuously?
All right, let's play our audio from our listener.
Hi, Trace and Julian. My name is Henry from Singapore. My question is, can we ever develop a way to breathe continuously? That is, can we ever develop a second mouth or something that allows us to breathe out while our previous mouth breathe in, so we have continuous oxygen exchange, I thought it would help us develop our muscles much better and make us become a stronger species. Hope you guys had fun with this one.
Yeah. So,
oh boy.
Right? Julian's face when he was, when Henry was talking.
I know. When I first saw the question, you know, I saw the question and then that sort of elaboration, that audio. First of all, Henry from Singapore, thank you for asking such a thoughtful question. I think it's really interesting. Yeah. So, in order to answer this, we have to go way back many Bakhtoons to the evolution of breathing in the first place. So, like, in order to attack this question, I think we need to take a minute to just sort of understand what is breathing in the first place. And it's something that essentially all animals do. So, like, I went deep on this one. I dug back. I'm looking like, okay, so all animals breathe, but that's actually not exactly true. I found an exception. This is very strange. So,
well, wouldn't anaerobic?
Yeah. So yeah. You've heard of anaerobic bacteria, perhaps, right? Yeah. Or maybe an anaerobic fungus or something like that. But you never think of animals as not needing, you know, to
breathe,
to get oxygen somehow, right?
This is just like a turtle out there that's just like, I'm born.
No, turtles, all turtles, I can say definitively, are aerobic respirators.
100% of turtles.
Wow,
you're not
bold
aerobically
claim.
Respirating, I can say for sure you are also not a living turtle. there is a strange animal, though. It's called Henegaia jockeyi. And that is almost certainly
perfect.
How you actually
nailed it.
Say it. It is a cnidarian. So that's the same phylum that includes things like jellyfish and coral, anemones, that kind of thing. It's a very, very, very small cnidarian. It's actually a parasite. It will infect salmon and things like that. And it, because it's a parasite, and this sort of thing happens in parasites kind of a lot, it has evolved to have less and less complex systems in it, including getting rid of its own mitochondria. I know. Yeah.
Oh.
The powerhouse of the cell?
Correct. Oh. It's really, really weird. It doesn't have mitochondria. And actually, the biologists who've studied and described it have this really bizarre... So how could that evolve? Like, other cnidarians all have mitochondria. They do some level of aerobic respiration. So how could this one do it? And they actually think the origin of this this bizarre parasite is that it started out as a cancerous tumor in, like, an ancient jellyfish and escaped and lives on its own.
What?
So it's like
that is a great horror movie concept.
It is, there's the theory for this kind of origin of species, you know, of a new species is called speciation by cancer development in animals. And the acronym that scientists use for that is SCANDAL.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow, what
this
a better
is,
one.
This is the thing, but yeah. In real life.
Yeah, it is a horror show, especially if you are a salmon. Thankfully, I am not a salmon, so I feel good.
I'm just imagining the salmon doctor's diagnosis of, like, bad news, you have parasites, and double bad news, it's also a cancer.
Yeah.
Bum, bum, bum.
But like a jellyfish cancer.
It's a jellyfish cancer.
Triple bad news, it's crawling its way out of you in order to live its own life.
Oh, yeah. So, all right, so that is... Okay, so that's kind of an aside that's not important to the story, but I couldn't
too bad.
Cool, I couldn't not tell you about it when I found it. If you're not Henegaia jockeyi, then you do need to breathe.
Hanny shocky.
Yeah, if you're not a hanny shocky, you're going to need to breathe. And I mentioned it before, and Tracy, you keyed in on the powerhouse of the cell, the mitochondria, right? This part of all our cells, this organelle inside of us, needs oxygen. So we need to breathe in order to give oxygen to these mitochondria. They make ATP that sort of powers the whole being alive thing that we do. Breathing also is useful for getting rid of things that you don't want. Some of our waste products are breathed out, carbon dioxide most notably, right? We breathe out CO2, which mm-hmm. is handy. That's also, interestingly, did you know that's how you lose weight? Like, if you work out and you lose weight, where does the weight go?
Right. It's the CO2.
You don't pee it out, and you don't
breath.
Poop it out. You breathe. Huh? You breathe it out. It is this, the carbon in the mass of the mass you're losing is exhaled as carbon dioxide.
Huh.
Yeah.
Cool.
Isn't that interesting?
Makes me feel better for, like, how hard it is to lose weight. It's like, oh yeah, it's easy to, like, eat a whole bunch, but it's so hard to exhale an equivalent amount of mass.
Right. Yeah. How many, like, exhausted breaths does it take for me to expel a cheeseburger? You know, it's so one of those tough questions. But that's not the question that Henry from Singapore asked.
No, true.
He asked about continuous breathing. And like I was mentioning, we do this oxidative phosphorylation mitochondria breathing thing, right? So we take in oxygen.
That's a lot of big words.
I know. It's expensive word. I'm getting that use out of that degree. I'm justifying those student loans to this day. But if you look at early animals, right, especially early vertebrates, like our ancestors were fishes, right? And they, in order for them to breathe, they don't use lungs like we do. They use gills. And that's handy for them. They pass water over their gills. And in seawater and in general, most freshwater also will have some level of oxygen dissolved in it. And right, as simple as your gills have these very tiny and numerous blood vessels. Water passes by them. If there's more oxygen in the water than there is in the fish blood, then oxygen will follow a chemical gradient. And there you go. Bing, bang, boom.
Yeah. Bing, bang, boom.
Bing, bang, boom. You've got metabolism going. but the thing is that fish have a really low metabolism compared to us. They're also, they're underwater. You may have noticed. Gills don't work well when you're not underwater. So like the structure of gills collapses in air and it doesn't work well for absorbing, oxygen in seawater is dissolved in water. And that's fundamentally different than the oxygen in the atmosphere around us. So we need some kind of different mechanism to absorb that. And, that's where lungs come in.
I always thought of oxygen as dissolved in air. I kept that to myself until now. But yeah, but you're right, because it's not really dissolved. Like that would imply
it's not
that oxygen is separate
by
from
the nitrogen
air.
In the air, right? Like in water, it is. There are water molecules around the oxygen that sort of keep it suspended in dissolved into solution. And the air, you could in a.
They're both fluids. One is denser, but that's. Right. It's not the same. It's not
There's
the same.
There's so much more oxygen, though, in the air, right? Like, oxygen's about 20%.
By percent, yes. Yeah. But there's just so much less stuff in air in general, right? Like, one cubic meter of air has a lot less atoms in it than a cubic meter of seawater. But it's also just hard to get. It's a very different way to access this oxygen. How are you going to get this oxygen into your blood, which is watery stuff, right? You've got to get oxygen to cross from being
really force it
a gas to being a dissolved gas in your own blood. And lungs are what we used to do. Interestingly, lungs are somewhat related to swim bladders. If you're a fan of bony fishes, you may be familiar with the swim bladder, which is like a sac inside of a fish that changes. It has not air, but something similar to air inside of it, a gas. And they can use that almost like the inside of a submarine. You know how people
like ballast?
Yeah. They can pump water or compressed air in and out of chambers to make a submarine more or less buoyant. Bony fishes at least do this as well. And lungs are thought to be sort of related to the swim bladder, not really closely related to the gills, which I think is interesting. So like your lungs are not like a version of fish gills that just decided to move inside and become bags of air. They're more closely, but weirdly, there's actually, so I was digging into this a bit, and scientists don't agree on which came first, the swim bladder or the lung. And there are some that actually say that lungs are older than swim bladders, and swim bladders are a derived form of lung.
That's what I had heard. Yeah.
Yeah. And a swim bladder is thought to be, sort of derived from part of a lung. But there are fish that have actual lungs, like lungy lungs. There's a fish called a lungfish.
Lungfish. Yeah.
Right, yes. The lung fish.
Very original.
We just put it out. Great headline for that YouTube video of an animal.
The lung fishes are actually closer related to us than they are to most of the other fishes out there. They're part of the so-called lobe-finned fishes, and so are you. This group of fishes that have fleshy, bony parts of their fins before they get to that sort of ray fin end of the fin. And if you actually look at a lungfish, you can see they can sort of move around and they can breathe air. And our ancestors are thought to have done the same thing. So
we can also breathe air.
Ideally, we could breathe air. But when we do it, it is not continuous. As Henry mentioned, our system, we have these bags in our bodies that we fill with air when we inhale. Gas exchange happens. Oxygen goes into the blood. Carbon dioxide comes out of the blood. And then we have to expel it and refresh it with fresh air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So, you know, that is non-continuous. However, there is a group of land animals that have evolved continuous breathing. They don't have two mouths, but they do have a lung that is constantly having air pushed through it from one end and out the other end. And yeah.
Julian, you're smiling so big right now.
I know this one. I don't want to steal any thunder, but I know this one.
It's everyone's favorite group of extant dinosaurs.
Yes, yes, my favorite reptiles.
Birds.
My favorite reptile as well, the birds. And actually, you know, this kind of breathing where birds do it, it's so weird. So their lungs don't expand or contract. They're sort of the same size. They have the same volume of stuff in them, of air in them all the time. But they have these air sacs inside of them on either side of their lungs. So they have these air sacs on one side that they'll fill up with air. Those air sacs, all they are basically like balloons inside the body of the bird. They don't do gas exchange. They're not switching oxygen and carbon dioxide out. They're just these little balloons inside of a bird. They fill them up with air, and then they push that air through the lungs, which do not change size or anything. And the lungs are where we get that gas exchange going, and then there's another set of air sacs on the other side, which will then sort of collect air from the lungs and then expel it out of the front of the bird. And it's almost like they have to breathe in twice to get this cycle through once.
Are you telling me, Ralph?
Yes.
That birds are basically bagpipes.
Birds are
bagpipes. Because if you know how a bagpipe works, you are blowing into the bag, which you are squeezing under your arm, and the bag is what is powering the instrument. But you're just constantly filling the bag with air.
Yes.
So, like, you breathing, you could do a whole bagpipe where you just have, like, I don't know, a generator pushing air into the bag and not blowing into it.
You know, it's so interesting that you mentioned this too, because birds don't have vocal cords the way we do either. You may have noticed that birds can sing very complex songs, and many birds can even sing more than one note at the same time, the way a bagpipe
does.
Yeah.
Wait, so are birds bagpipes dinosaurs?
I mean, you can't easily prove they aren't. I mean,
prove to me they're not.
But yeah, I mean,
we're just asking questions on this podcast.
I'm picturing a more quote unquote accurate Jurassic Park remaster, and they give all the dinosaurs feathers, right? But then they also make the T-Rex roar just a bagpipe wail, just like when it like crushes the little velociraptors, and then it's just like,
if you listen to the bagpipe. I feel like the T-Rex roar already is a little bagpipey. It does sound like it's more than one note at the same time. Yeah. So, yes, in this sense, birds are bagpipe adjacent, at least.
Same family.
Part of the question, like, can we evolve to breathe continuously? Depending on what you mean by we, you know, land and vertebrates, the tetrapods have done this already. It has been evolved, not with two mouths, as Henry suggested, but yes, a continuous breathing. And this actually makes sense. The birds have a higher metabolism than we do, and especially when they're flying, their need for oxygen is extreme, right? They need an awful lot of oxygen in order to power those extremely large muscles, the breast muscles that are flapping those wings and doing all that intense work. This is also why you'll often see birds eat an awful lot too. They burn a lot of gas, you know, and they need a big, like, they're like a muscle car or something. Like, they have a big intake, a fancy intake system. And so yes, this has been evolved, but not in, you know, evolution doesn't work like, I can't evolve myself to now have bird breathing. That's just, you know, evolution doesn't work that way. However, it has evolved once in the vertebrates already. And, you know, many millions of years from now, we can't evolve that way, but perhaps our distant descendants could.
Trace has a question. Trace, why is your hand raised?
I would like to know if using CRISPR, we could take genes from these dinosaur/birds and engineer a future mammal with that breathing system.
Could we, the three of us? Probably not.
Well, that's not going to stop me. Listen, I've got a whole bunch of birds that I've caught.
Oh, man.
Down at the beach. And we're going to try this thing.
There's a lot going on there. I think it would be really, really challenging. I wouldn't say it's impossible. Just very, very, very difficult to do. And also perhaps not a good investment of resources, you know. Take billions of dollars and decades.
So yeah. Elon Musk will attempt this.
Oh, yeah. He could do it.
Yeah. He's going to try it.
Part of my understanding why this happened with birds is because, like, the way that our lungs work now of, like, breathe into these big sacs with these smaller sacs, right, and then, like, squeeze all the air out is not terribly efficient in terms of the volume that it takes up. Like, there's these big dead areas, right, in, like, the corners of our lungs that just
air doesn't... And we're also not expelling all the air in our lungs every time, right?
Yeah, like
there's a lot of sort of dead air that sort of mixes around in there, but we're not going from a full lung to a completely empty lung to a completely full of fresh air lung every time.
Right. But if you're a bird that flies, right, like if you've got any sort of extra mass that's like, because your lungs are bigger, because you have to get like this amount of air and deal with the inefficiency of like the air in, air out lung that, you know, we have, it's a disadvantage, right? You're like, you're heavier, you're going to take more energy to actually get into the air. So there's a selective pressure for these other types of lungs, like that allows them to gain an advantage. But for us, like down here on the ground, walking around, like who cares if we just have a little bit of extra mass, you know, and we're not using all that space in our lungs. Like there's no pressure to get rid of that. So
no,
like we're
sure.
not going to naturally evolve this more efficient breathing system unless something is pushing us to breathe more efficiently.
Right. There's like a selection pressure.
Exactly.
Right. Although I should mention, right, like this is, so birds are a kind of theropod dinosaur. It is not known exactly when that kind of breathing apparatus showed up. Is that breathing apparatus something that would have also been present in, say, like a sauropod dinosaur or maybe even one of the ornithopod dinosaurs like a Stegosaurus or a Triceratops? I don't think that is well understood. You've got to wonder, did, you know, the early relative of the dinosaurs, the pterosaurs, right, the flying reptiles that are not technically dinosaurs but right. lived in a similar time, did they have that kind of anatomy? And the thing is, it's soft tissue, right? So for paleontologists, yeah. there's not, as far as
really
I'm
rare.
Aware, really great fossil record at the moment. That doesn't mean it's impossible. I mean, there have been some soft tissue fossils out there. You know, when did that selective pressure happen? We know that the early archosaurs, the group that evolved into dinosaurs and birds, was already bipedal and probably a lot more like go get 'em, high metabolism, running around than maybe some of our ancestors were. But, you know, evolution is complex that way. And it's a rabbit hole that was fun. Like, it's a fun, silly question, but it opens up, I think, an interesting rabbit hole that I enjoy going down. And these questions of, you know, how did the life around us come to be the way it is? It's fascinating stuff. And we also know way more about it than you might guess. Like, if you haven't gone down a paleontology genetic DNA analysis that people who do phylogeny can do now, like, there's an awful lot that we know. And I think that's really, that was one of the more fascinating things. And that's sort of the evolution side of this question to me. Like, I went down that way. But then the other part that was in the text version of the question that was sort of implied, is there a way that we could engineer it? And the answer to that is also yes. And it's already been done.
Gasp, yeah. Shock, horror.
Yes, shock, horror, a medical miracle. It's so, have you ever heard of a heart and lung machine?
Yeah.
That's
heart and lung machine.
That does this. So it's not something that you would use to be more athletic, right? But if you are having
attached
major open heart surgery, they have to stop your heart. Like if they replace a valve in your heart, they have to stop it. And normally stopping your heart is very bad for your health.
Generally not recommended.
So how do they keep your blood from dropping all its oxygen and you from experiencing immediate death when they do that? They have this machine. It's sort of in pop culture known as a heart and lung machine. It is more professionally known as cardiopulmonary bypass, which does what it sounds like it does. It bypasses your cardiopulmonary system. Your lungs and heart get bypassed by this machine that both sort of pumps your blood. So they use these big tubes that take blood from before your heart and then put it back in after your heart. And in the in-between, it pumps it through this machine that will oxygenate the blood. And actually, it will also sometimes change the temperature of the blood. When people are going through open heart surgeries, this is, of course, a very challenging environment. The body doesn't like it when you cut open the chest and stop the heart.
Okay, let me write that down.
Yeah, don't do that.
Be careful. Not that you can't do it, but it's tough. It's really hard on the body. So they often will sort of induce hypothermia to slow down the body's metabolism and all those systems. So one of the ways they do it is they cool the blood down in the heart and lung machine before they put it back. So they use your own blood as a coolant fluid.
Wow.
Oh, cool.
I love modern medicine. It's so wild.
It's wild. And this was developed in the 1950s. So it's modern medicine, but it's not that new.
Modern medicine. You know, that's
but
like
it's also
70
not something
years
you
ago.
Can do all day. You know, a heart and lung machine, first, it's bypassing your whole heart. Usually your chest is open at this point. It's not something you would do if you were trying to run a better marathon. And it's also not something you can do for too long. Typically, you know, surgeons try and keep you under 6 hours when you're on this machine. There's all sorts of blood clotting issues that happen. It doesn't do as good a job as your heart and lungs. I think in general, your lungs don't like not having blood flowing through them for that long. It's tricky stuff. It's above my pay grade. I am not a heart surgeon, believe it or not. Obviously there's, and it's a really interesting topic as well. That's a rabbit hole that's fun to go down. And there are more lung specific versions that are not as commonly used. They call it just an artificial lung. I saw someone was on one of those for maybe about a month, which is quite a long time, but that is to bridge. You wouldn't, again, not something you would do to be like a superhuman athlete. This is something to bridge somebody to a lung transplant, that kind of situation. So could we engineer it? The answer is yes, but neither trying to evolve ourselves or engineer ourselves to breathe continuously seem like a good idea if you just want to get good at sports or something. I feel like
so far my technology optimism is like, look, this was invented in the 1950s. Let's say we put some resources behind it to miniaturize it. Let's get the 200 years from now, the future of a cardiopulmonary bypass is just like, okay, I'm bypassing my heart for this race. Let's go.
Yeah. Oh man, can you imagine there would be like a cyborg Olympics at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah, you just slap it on your chest, plug it in to yourself.
I have heard that there are some, you know, there are athletes who have artificial limbs who actually can outrun most, like who could outrun me easily.
Yeah.
And you know, you got maybe artificial heart, add that to the list. And it's critical for life, but you know, breathing isn't that complicated, right? Like if you expose the blood nicely enough to air, it sort of chemical gradients do the thing. Like the hemoglobin in your blood likes oxygen just the right amount. And the CO2 in your blood isn't even in blood cells. It's just dissolved in the blood. And it leaves anytime it's exposed to air that has less CO2 in it than it does. So,
you know,
it's not the
one,
craziest idea.
Thinking about this, I'm glad that we evolved a continuous digestive tract and a in-out breathing system and not the other way around.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, Julie.
Let me tell you.
Because Cnidarians do not have an all-the-way-through digestive system. Cnidarians like that horrifying parasite we mentioned earlier, but jellyfish and corals and things like that, their mouth is also their anus.
Yes,
they have.
And it all comes
take
full
food in,
circle.
They hold on to it for a while till it's not food anymore, and then
break it down.
They get rid of it through the
they
same
poop
door
out of their
in.
Mouths.
That's right.
That could have been us, Henry. Be glad it's a two-way breathing system.
Yeah. Oof. Can you imagine a future where people are just like, "Hey, man, you turn into the cyborg games this weekend?" And you're like, "Nah, I like the natural human sports."
Oh, you're snob.
And they're like, "Not as fast. They don't hit as hard. Not as cool." That's basically non-football fans listening to American football now. They're just like, "Oh, no, they don't go as fast. They don't hit as hard. Mm-mm. Not into it." So there's definitely going to be an audience for the, like, cyborg sports.
Oh, and I want them to be, like, if it's stuff like a foot race, I would love to see a normal human versus cyborg man you know. Just
like, don't worry, it'll be on Fox.
I want that for the Fox Olympics special too. Actually, I'd love to see just like what does somebody who is made out of Jello and does sits on the look googling weird stuff all the time. What did they? How do they do in a sprint against Usain Bolt?
The normal man.
Honestly,
yeah.
I love that meme of like every Olympics there should just be one average person. Just to see how fast and how strong all these people are. How far did they throw the javelin? 8 meters.
Yeah.
60.
Way to go. For all you out there who's sitting on your couch going, I could do that. Here you go. Here's your chance. Sign up.
Yeah. Amazing.
I love it.
All right. With that, thank you, Henry, for your question. Let's take another break and come back for Julian's question. All right, welcome back, everybody. If you haven't been paying attention, we answer silly questions with science. That's pretty much the pithiest I could be about this podcast.
Nailed it. Good pith.
We've answered two questions already about time and about evolving ourselves to breathe continuously and or engineering. And we have one more question to go. So, Julian, what was your question?
So the question I tackled, as is tradition, when we have a guest, we have them ask a question and then one of us does our best to actually answer it. And so this question comes from Ralph, kind of. So, Ralph, what was your question?
Okay, so it does come from me, but it is inspired by your show. Did an episode earlier, classic episode, one of my top 20 favorites.
Episode seven.
You answered the question, what is the pointiest thing? And that got my wheels turning. And I wanted to ask now, so now that we know what the pointiest thing is, what is the least pointy thing?
You know, Ralph, I knew I liked you. I knew from our first phone call where we got to know each other and we discovered we were both hockey fans.
Go Pens, by the way.
Yeah. Go my bottom-dwelling San Jose Sharks. You want to talk about a real parasite on the league? Go my team. Okay. So, but the moment you asked this question, I about died because, as it turned out, buried deep in our list of questions, I, possibly slightly drunk, added... Right after we did the what is pointiest episode, I added what is the unpointiest thing.
Yes.
So
it's
I appreciate
floating around in there
that Ralph asked this, but
yeah.
It's also kind of my own question, which feels like cheating, but I'm going to get to do it anyway because Ralph asked it. So it's technically okay for me to answer. But here's the thing is where do you even start? Right. Like,
yeah.
When I did the pointiest thing episode, it was actually kind of a pain to define pointiness, if that makes sense. Like, I found sources. First of all, everything I looked up wanted to tell me about the sharpest thing, you know, and there's definitions of that involve like the radius of the cutting edge and then the wedge angle of the blade and blah, 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 blah. And eventually I just settled like, okay, I'm just going to go with like the narrowest a point can be in terms of like molecular size and found this, articles about a tungsten nano needle, right, where the tip had been basically chemically whittled down to a single string of atoms, right? But
for all the details, go listen to episode 7.
Episode 7, yeah. But what's the opposite of that? Like, where do we talk about like something
smoothness?
Smooth is a good one.
Well,
do we talk about like
pointy things have to be solid, right?
Yeah. Okay.
It can't,
yeah. Right.
You can't have a pointy gas, but is the same
what's
true?
Well, here's the thing. Here's
what's
the thing,
opposite
Ralph?
Of pointy? Like, that's really, is that what we're trying to answer? What's the, what the opposite of pointy is?
Kind of, yes. But Ralph, about saying you can't have a pointy gas, I mean, you sure about that? You
having
sure
like
about
a
that?
Freak out over here.
Yeah, right?
No,
my brain
like,
is I'm, my
well,
brain.
You can certainly seemingly have a pointy liquid, right? Like I've seen like a water jet cutter that seems very pointy.
Well, there's plasma cutters. You could have high pressure. Yeah, absolutely. In metalworking, you have basically a jet of gas that you ionize as it comes out of the nozzle and turn it into plasma and concentrate it. And it just cuts through metal like butter.
But is cutting pointiness?
Well,
right?
Maybe
like,
piercing
your tungsten
directly
nano
through.
Needle probably couldn't cut through a piece of sheet steel.
No,
cut through paper.
A piece of sheet. Yeah.
You could poke
with it, though, right? But you can poke if you just don't move the plasma cutter, right? Then you're just piercing. Does that count as being pointy?
I think no. I feel like a plasma cutter is not pointy.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I feel like it might not be. It might be more melty.
The thing is, it's really just punching through this metal, though, right? Like, to me, it sounds like piercing. So I'm not even going to say that, like, a gas is or is not pointy, because, you know, in the right circumstances, you could make gas pointy, or like you said, liquid pointy, right? If you've got a jet of water. So I'm not going to focus on that. I get to make the rules here, because it's arbitrary. We're defining what is and isn't
true.
Pointy, right?
True.
But I'm with you on, I think it should be something solid, right? I'm with you on that.
Got it.
Since the tungsten nanometer is solid and it was human-made, there's also that aspect, right? Because we could start talking about really abstract things, right? Like, what's the opposite of pointy? Nothing. And I mean that in a literal sense. Yeah, exactly. But like empty space devoid of any matter, right? Would you say that's pointy or not pointy or even a thing? Whoa. I don't know. It kind of gets a bit mind bending. And worse, and here's a fun little side alley that we can go down. There's no such thing as nothing.
True.
So, well, is quantum foam pointy?
Oh, see, there you go, Ralph. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's a great question. Probably not. I mean, I don't think you can pierce anything with quantum foam. But for those listening who aren't, you know, big old nerds like us, I'll tell you about quantum foam a little bit. So if you were to take some volume, right, and just pump all of the matter out of it, like get a perfect vacuum and shield it from any energy, and think that you have nothing inside, you still wouldn't have nothing. If you zoomed in to like a quantum scale, you would see what some scientists describe as like a foam, where these virtual particles come in and out of existence. And it might be a little confusing to think of them as actual particles, you know, we describe them that way, but all particles are just like disturbances in fields, right? Like a photon is a disturbance in the electric field and the magnetic field that permeates the entire universe, right? So these little fluctuations and variations that just stem from the nature of, you know, the quantum world being unpredictable and weird mean that tiny little pockets of disturbances come in and out of existence constantly, and we call those virtual particles. And they are always going to be there, even if you think you've gotten rid of every single piece of matter and shield it completely from energy. It's just not possible to have nothing.
Nothing.
Right.
Wow.
So
in,
nothing.
In our universe.
In our universe.
So in a real way, nothing is impossible, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow,
put that on a t-shirt, like with the full explanation
on
the back.
Motivational poster.
Nothing is impossible. And then on the back. So if you zoom in, there's quantum foam. You have to really read the fine print.
Yeah.
It is a good one, though. It's a good piece of motivation. So I didn't like that at all. I thought like it was starting to kind of get away from me. And again, I came back to, okay, let's try and find something human made that is the opposite of pointy, right? Mm-hmm. And Trace, you brought up this idea, like, what if it's really smooth? I like that.
Super smooth.
What if something that was incredibly smooth? And there are examples of very, very smooth things that we've created for various reasons. Like in 2008, scientists in Madrid created the smoothest mirror ever. They took a wafer of silicon that was 50 microns thick, and then they covered it with a layer of lead that was just 1 to 2 nanometers thick. And they did this at like minus 133 Celsius, like very cold. And I have no idea how how to describe how it works, because the scientists were just basically like, yeah, and then some magic happens and it smooths out the lead. And I'm like, that's not very helpful or a very scientific explanation. But basically they say like these quantum forces between the lead and the silicon stretched the lead into a very fine, smooth surface where it's only across the whole surface, like a couple atoms variation in height. And most of it, like 94% of it, is uniform height. So a very, very, very smooth mirror. Yeah, the purpose of this mirror, it's funny, the tungsten nanoneedle
was... the Florida of mirrors.
Just flat. as far as the eye can see. The tungsten nanoneedle was created in order to image like incredibly small objects, like actual atoms. And it, funny enough, this mirror was created with the goal of using it for atomic microscopy. You've heard of electron microscopes, where that you shoot a beam of electrons at an object. And because we talked about all particles are really waves, the wavelength of electrons is much smaller than that of the wavelengths of light, of visible light. So you can get much finer resolution when they bounce off an object and, you know, into some sort of receiver, and you basically disentangle those images, right? You can get really, really, really fine details from electron microscopes. But a problem with it is you have to shoot this beam of electrons at whatever you're trying to sample. And a lot of times it's like something delicate, like a biological sample. And
I hate getting shot by beams of electrons.
It's really ruins my day. And yeah, you can damage that sample. So the thinking with these atomic microscopes that these scientists were trying to develop is you'll shoot larger atoms, but with less energy at whatever it is you're trying to image. And so you won't actually destroy the sample, but it's got to bounce off of this mirror like once it goes through your sample and go to a receiver. So they needed something really, really smooth to reflect these atoms. So that's one candidate. But you could also
Very smooth mirror.
Very candidate smooth mirror. One. Candidate one. You could also have, say, a very perfectly smooth round object.
Ooh, that does seem somehow less pointy than a smooth flat object.
Weird.
Because the flat object has edges.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's got a edge.
But if you've got something very spherical, right, there's no edge to speak of.
Right.
And I thought about, like, okay, what if we did this, like, ooh, the Earth. You know, they always say if the Earth was, like, shrunk down to the size of a cue ball, like, the variances on the surface of the Earth, like, the highest mountains and the lowest, you know, bottom of the ocean would be, like, less than the variations on a cue ball. But I've found something that, when scaled up or down, is even smootherer than the Earth would be with all its mountains and valleys and whatnot. And it was, funny enough, this episode is kind of weirdly very well packaged and fitting very nicely. It was a sphere that scientists created in order to establish what a kilogram is.
Oh my, yes. Yes!
Yes!
The kilogram.
The kilogram.
I know this sphere. That's a beautiful sphere.
It is beautiful.
It is.
Oh, I've wanted to hold it for so long just because it would be like, is this what it feels like to hold perfection?
Yeah. I mean, that was the goal, right? So when the French were coming up with all of these units of standardized measurement, that's how you say it. That's the correct way. They came up with all these beautifully elegant different measurements and ways to interrelate them to each other. And over time, we have found mathematical ways of describing all of them, except for a long time, the kilogram, right? And fun little side note about the kilogram. Originally, it was the standard unit, SI unit for mass was going to be the grov, based on like gravitas, but it sounded too much like a French title of nobility. So they changed it to gram, right? And like a 1,000th of a grov. And then they said, okay, well, it's still kind of a pain to work with just grams. So the kilogram will be the standard SI unit for mass. And that's why kilogram is the only one of all the standard SI units that has a prefix of kilo. Because they didn't want to invoke French nobility because they were right in revolutionary times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Funny how politics still actually kind of intermingles with the history of things. You might not think about it, but that's why kilogram is like the standard. Okay. So the difficulty with the kilogram is they basically just needed a sample of a kilogram to be the definitive kilogram. They just made a weight and they pointed at it and they said, this is a kilogram. This thing weighs exactly 1 kilogram. But objects are funny in that, like, if you store them at different temperatures or, you know, different processes like rust occur and the material degrades. Yeah, if you add a fingerprint, you'll change the value of a kilogram, right? So they built, like, they cast identical replicas of the kilogram when they made the definitive kilogram, and they stored them in different countries so those countries could have, like, a reference point for a kilogram. And they were all supposed to be in the same conditions, but, like, over time, the values of all these things diverged from each other. And
I feel like this is like the Lord of the Rings, but with the metric system. You know, like there's all these different kilograms were made, but then there's like one kilogram to rule them
To rule them all. Yeah.
Don't drop it in the fire, though, because then it'll change. It's
in a basement in France.
And there's just one French guy named Gollum. He just holds on to it.
My precious.
I feel like Mordor does sound French, right?
Like, yeah, kind of does.
And you would destroy this kilogram by casting it into a fire, into the lava to melt it, and therefore destroy all the units of weights that we've
developed.
And
I feel like
forever.
Paris of the 1790s probably resembled Mount Doom in many ways also.
Maybe.
You know, the French Revolution was pretty rough from what I understand.
It was pretty rough.
Wasn't there, but...
It's hard to overthrow the people who live down the street.
I've never tried either. But.
I have, but I was repelled, but I'll try again. So about a decade ago, though, they were like, okay, instead of this old weight from 200 years ago, now with modern machining and science and our ability to craft very precise objects, what if we made a sphere as perfect as we can make it out of silicon 28 atoms? And we ground it really, really smooth into a really fine sphere. And then because we can calculate the volume of a sphere and we know the density of silicon atoms, we can calculate how many atoms there are in this sphere. And then we'll say this many silicon atoms equals 1 kilogram, definitively. And that's it. So they ground this sphere down. They took this chunk of silicon atoms and just kept polishing that thing over and over and over until it was so smooth. In mathy terms, right, it had a roundness delta being change, of less than 50 nanometers. Now, that's probably meaningless to everybody listening.
Yeah, that is.
So to put it in the if Earth were the size of this thing, or if this were the size of Earth, like, perspective, if you were to scale this ball of silicon atoms up to the size of the Earth, the difference in elevation between the lowest low and the highest peak would be 14 meters.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So... it just like, oh, you want to go on a hike up a mountain? And it's just like 50
like
feet later. You're like, we've done
feet,
it. Yeah. Oh, I'm exhausted. It's so high up here.
So
the elevation.
Smoother than Florida, then.
It
even
is.
Even smoother than Florida.
Even smoother than Floridia.
Wow.
Right. That, I think, great candidate for being the least
pointy
thing.
There's something that's less pointy than a ball that would just, if you touched it, you'd go,
in my unprofessional opinion, yes.
Okay.
Okay.
When it's less pointy.
Well.
I ran out of air.
If you think, well, you got to have the one-way breathing.
If only I could have continuously been breathing. Oh, dang it. Henry.
Okay. Unfortunately, this involves a bit of math and geometry.
Oh, good. Perfect.
But basically, if you define a point, right, like something with a positive curvature, it from that point, everything curves away from it in the same direction, right? So even though a sphere has no edges, right, like any point on it, there's a positive curvature because everything's curving away from it the same way. Any direction you choose, you know, you'll bend the same way away from it. You can have a negative curvature of a shape if when you walk in one direction, you know, it's like you're walking, let's say, downhill from the point you started at. But from that same starting point, if you turn 90 degrees and started walking, you would go uphill. That in mathematics is a negative curvature. Basically, a saddle shape. So,
like a Pringle.
Like
a Pringle.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like a delicious Pringle.
That's a perfect analogy. So, I think, in my humble opinion, the least pointy thing needs to be something that humans have made, something that has a negative curvature to be the opposite of pointy, and I think it should just generally be large because it should be difficult to actually use it for piercing anything, you know? Like, maybe a Pringle, I don't know, edge of a Pringle, you could do it?
Yeah, I mean, I've crunched a Pringle and had it kind of poke the roof of my mouth if I'm a little aggressive with it, you know. That feels pointy.
But also, since Ralph is here, and Ralph likes hockey and I like hockey and he'll appreciate this, I decided I'm ready to crown the least pointy object in the universe, or the most pointless thing in the universe, and that is the Saddle Dome in Calgary, where the Calgary Flames play. It's a hockey arena with a roof shaped like a saddle. So it's got a negative curvature. It's obviously built by humans, and it's very large, so it would be difficult to actually penetrate anything with it.
Right.
And this...
It's pointless to be a Flames fan, so...
Yeah, it is very pointless, because you can have a great season and still lose the most goals by one game and miss the playoffs, and it's disappointing. So there you have it, Ralph. I hope I answered your question.
That was better than I could ever have imagined.
Yeah, the most pointless thing.
I have a vague memory that the universe might be saddle-shaped... because of negative curvature.
Yeah, you know, I almost got into this rabbit hole of like, could you call the universe the least pointy thing? And then like, should we redefine my answer from episode 7 as the most pointy thing being a black hole because it's a singularity? But it all just felt too
a little esoteric.
Exactly. But yes, there are the, you know, ideas that the universe could be a closed universe, which would basically be a giant
bubble.
The idea is, you know, if gravity were to win out and kind of shape the universe into this curve shape, you could theoretically start at one point, travel in a straight line, and still end up where you started. Then there is the negative curvature universe
of
idea.
An open universe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's like if you were to travel, if two, say, rocket ships were to travel parallel to each other because of the negative curvature, they would actually split off and move away from each other. But what we seem to live in is a flat universe, which is neither. It's just like if two things travel in a straight line, parallel.
They don't get closer together. They don't get further apart.
Yep. And they don't end up back where they start.
Not that we can tell based on the scale of our universe and how we can measure it.
But the evidence that we've collected points to us living in a flat universe. Yeah.
Yeah.
So also maybe answer to your question, the
universe
least pointy thing, the universe itself.
But that could be, you know.
But then the universe also contains a tungsten.
The most pointy thing, I know. I know. But on average, if you average out the universe.
Yeah.
I like the Calgary answer. I think that's the best.
Me too.
Yeah, that one's pretty good. These are my favorite kind of questions, listeners, just so you know. Just because it's like there's not really a right answer or a wrong answer. It's more just like, let's explore this. Similar, Ralph, your question too. It's just like, let's figure it out. That's just the best. Yeah. I love questions like
How
that.
Can I use this as a vehicle for other fun science learning?
Yeah, because if you think about it, even a sphere that is perfectly smooth and the size of a kilogram, you know, like a cannonball or like a small, you can hold it in your hands. If you were, I don't know, a giant and stepped on it, it would feel pointy like a Lego piece. You know, it would feel like Princess and the Pea kind of situation. It's going to feel like a lump, which is pointy because it has some curvature. So unless you had something perfectly smooth and so flat that it reached the edge of the universe, that would be like the least pointy thing.
But I feel like the universe isn't a solid. What's the biggest? What is the biggest solid sphere in the universe? I mean, Earth is pretty big.
Would you it's call it
Earth? Is
what do
the
you
biggest
mean by solid?
Yeah,
I mean the boundary is not defined by gas, plasma, or liquid, and it is full of densely packed atoms and not like dark matter or something.
Right.
So like in our solar system, the Earth is the largest rocky body.
Right.
And once you get bigger than a certain size, they're all spherical, right? Like hydrostatic equilibrium.
And ours is smoother because of our atmospheric processes than the ones without atmospheric.
We got all sorts
of erosion
going on here.
You know, Mars is less smooth than we are in some ways because of its large mountains and big chasms.
Oh, Olympus Mons. Yeah, that's a big...
Yeah, that's big.
But it's not that pointy. You know, if you were to stand on it, you know, it's like, it's also really wide. It's like the size of
France. Then it's, what do you mean by pointy and the scale of pointy? Like pointy to a human?
Right.
Pointy to a planet? Pointy to a star? Because
something
that's pointy...
Pointy
like,
to a star, because like you can't even poke a hole in a star. Like
if you...
I can't.
I can't. Anyways, this was fun. Thank you for your question, Henry. And thank you for your question, Ralph. Thank you for answering them.
Thank you for having me along. This is a ridiculous and hilarious and fun time. I appreciate
it. I'm so glad. Yeah. Good to
have
you.
Thanks for being here, Ralph. Yeah, Ralph, where can people find you and follow you if they want to learn more about you after this podcast?
Well, the biggest thing I do is I'm the writer and producer for Practical Engineering, which is a YouTube channel hosted by my good friend and boss, Grady Hillhouse. And it is all about the engineered world, you know, whether it's dams or bridges or trains or, you know, sort of some of the fundamentals about how engineering works. But it's for anybody. It's fun. It's curious. And then, I don't know, you can find me on like social media things. I'm on Instagram as just Ralph Crew. I do have a, at the moment, dormant, my own little YouTube channel called Isn't That Something, which
I love it.
If I ever get enough time to do a my own channel again, I'll go back to it. It was super fun. But yeah, those are good places to start. But yeah, my the thing I'm most proud of that I get to work on in my full-time gig is Practical Engineering. And if somehow you're not already a fan of it, if you're a fan of this show, I feel like the curiosity gap that we get to explore there is super fun. I think you'll like it.
Awesome.
Great. Thanks for listening, everybody. We appreciate you so much. Please leave a review for That's Absurd. Please elaborate wherever you are listening, or, you know, you can star or you can write something. That would be great. And if you do, let us know. And, you know, maybe we'll send you a sticker or something if you tell us. Tell your friends about the show. Share the show on your socials. You can tag us. We're on Threads and in Facebook and Instagram at That's Absurd Show. And shout out to our Nebula audience. We like seeing you submit your questions. It's so awesome whenever you tell us that you are a Nebula supporter, because if you listen on Nebula, we get support from that as well. So woo-hoo! If y'all want to...
I am actually a big fan of Nebula too, because that is also where you can find Practical Engineering.
It's so good. There's so many smart, great shows on Nebula.
Yeah, we're Nebula cousins already.
I love that. So shout out to them. Thanks for that. You support the show by that. If you haven't joined Nebula, you can. And if you're listening on Nebula now, I'm sorry that this sort of became an ad for Nebula. I apologize. But too bad for that. I hope you love it too. So if you want to submit a question for a future episode, go to thatsabsurdshow.com/ask, or you can look down in the show notes here and just click on the link in the description. And, you know, you can also do that to follow the show, share the show with your friends, or again, leave us a review. So thanks for that so much. We will see you in 2 weeks with another episode of That's Absurd. Please elaborate. And in the meantime, you know, Happy New Year and stuff, even though time is meaningless and nothing is smooth and we cannot continuously breathe forever, unfortunately, for everyone.
Nailed it.